Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann, sharing stories of our food.
And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann. Today, I'm welcomed by my co-host, Renee Vaslios. Hey, Renee, how you doing?
Good, Aaron. It's wonderful to be back.
Yes, you have been a frequent contributor, and I appreciate that. You always bring great insight.
Well, I'm excited to be here.
Hey, Renee, let me just read a little bit of your background here. So you're a Dutch-American agricultural economist with over 15 years of agriculture industry know-how, underlined. Your expertise ranges from strategic marketing analysis and product development to sales, marketing, and distribution strategy. With nearly a decade of international work and experience in Amsterdam and Beijing, you have a good understanding of what is going on to feed a shrinking planet. Today, your company, Banyan Consulting, leverages your global cross-functional experience with workings in the past with USDA and John Deere to support growth of sustainability-focused agricultural businesses.
Yes,
that's right.
Yes.
That's good. Well, I know from our past conversations and from our meetings prior that you bring a wealth of knowledge and your expertise is welcome. So thanks again for participating. So Renee, let me share this. Okay, one of the things we always get here when we're in the recording studio, our engineer will ask us what we have for breakfast. It's the common thing of like a sound check. And this morning I had a very large, delicious glass of fresh squeezed orange juice. Oh man, nothing like great fresh squeezed orange juice, right? It's like a boost of energy. You feel like you're healthier. All that vitamin C. It's just good stuff. Maybe the only thing that is not good with that is after if you brush your teeth first and then have that OJ, not the best, right? But I was doing a little research here and realized and found out that Sao Paulo, Brazil, and Florida make up 85% of global orange production. That statistic is a bit dated. Brazil exports 99% of that, and conversely, 90% of what's going to Florida is consumed stateside. Interesting to know that. We drink a lot of OJ here, mostly from domestic production. I'd say that that stat is a bit misleading. Brazil actually produces nearly three times the volume of Florida. Again, these stats are older, and we're going to talk a little more about how this has evolved as we get into the show here. But I found it interesting to know that I didn't know Brazil was that big of a producer of oranges and orange juice for global production. Things have been changing in domestic production. Florida obviously has run into some big problems. The Honglongbing, I don't know if I said that right or not, but it's a citrus greening. The Chinese translation of Honglongbing is yellow dragon disease, which actually is a vector transmitted pathogen that's caused by a certain bacteria. It's decimated the Floridian citrus production. So from 2000 to 2010, Florida lost about 30% of its total crop. And they've had issues that have intensified every year because they haven't figured out a great way to deal with this. And last year, 2017, it was a supremely difficult year for Florida. They lost nearly 70% of their crop due to Hurricane Irma. So it's been a challenge for what we think of. I think everyone thinks of orange juice when you go get it with fresh squeezed or, even the well drink of orange juice. It's coming from Florida, right? Not from concentrate. For concentrate, it's usually from Florida is what we think. But those things are changing. And to remediate that, to change that here domestically, we've changed that. The citrus industry is actually turning to different varieties, but mostly different regions to offset that loss, to hedge their bets, to diversify and change their portfolio. We're starting to look at this almost like an assets, right? Of assets of how we can maximize production and still retain those values. So California has picked up a lot of that domestic production, and they're actually nearing total production of Florida in recent years. But they've had some issues too. So last October, a guy named Joel Nelson, who's the president of California Citrus Mutual, which represents more than 80% of the state citrus industry, said the California citrus crop is smaller than it's been in the past 5 or 6 years. And they're attributing that to two things, which is the rain, which knocked off a lot of the spring blossoms, but also, and this is what we probably have been more aware with what our listeners would think of, which is the trees are still really tired from drought. Right, we've heard the stories in California with the drought. So today we got an interesting person to join us that's going to share some information with us about investment across the board in agriculture, in citrus, and really looking at regenerative and holistic methodology of putting capital to work for sustainable best practices. Today we welcome Wood Turner, who's the Senior Vice President of Agriculture Capital. Hey, Wood, how you doing?
Hey, Aaron, how are you?
I was going to say, and please, Renee.
Hi, great to have you on, Wood.
Hey, Wood, I was going to say thanks for joining from sunny California and hot California, but as we talked about in the precursor, you're in the Bay Area, so you got a nice tempered 65 degrees. We chatted a bit about, and I think our listeners will be interested, if the wildfires are affecting you or if you've seen the adverse effect. How are things going on there in California?
You know, in the Bay Area, I feel like it's the classic example, the classic case of a bubble in so many ways. Let me count the ways, by the way. It's nice and chilly here and feels you can't tell that much of the state is burning around us. Some folks have talked about ashes on cars and on trees and things like that. I was in the Valley, Central Valley, a couple days ago. Where many of our operations are, and you could really smell the fires and really feel the heat. But it's a challenging time, and obviously with the fires starting a lot earlier this year than I think we normally expect them in California, I think it's bringing to light probably a lot of issues related to climate change, which is certainly one of the issues that I'm interested in and focused on here. So.
Yeah, we had Gina McCarthy on a previous show, and from the EPA, and she'd mentioned there's a very large conference that's happening in September, Governor Brown, that's be hosting on climate change. So I'm sure that will be a large part of the conversation next month as this think tank comes together and starts looking at how we can start doing things differently. So Wood, let me do this, if I could. I'm going to just give a quick reading of your background and a little bit about agriculture capital, and then we'll jump into questions.
Sounds great.
All right. So Wood brings over 20 years of experience in corporate sustainability, environmental management, and consumer engagement. Most recently, he was the executive team at organic yogurt pioneer Stonyfield Farm as the company's VP of Sustainable Innovation. Prior to that, he was the founding executive director of Climate Counts, an international NGO focused on measuring and scoring the world's largest consumer companies on their enterprise-level responsible responses to climate change. Wood has consulted to brands. He's worked with elected officials. He's worked with public agencies on modernizing the public around ideas that improve the environment and build communities. So Wood, that is a fantastic background, and we're excited to learn more about what you're doing at Agriculture Capital. So what I read on the website is Agriculture Capital team is aligned in its mission to grow access to healthy, sustainable food. That you've assembled experienced professionals from finance, farming, processing, marketing, and sustainability to bring innovative thinking to managing successful food enterprises. So if you could you share with our listening audience a bit more about what your industry is doing? And I read that here that you're focused on integrating those and operationalizing the firm's cross-platform sustainability strategies. So what is your responsibility at Agriculture Capital as well?
Well, it's so hard to hear your background read back to you like that. I'm having a little bit of an existential moment here. What have I done? Where am I going? What am I doing? But thanks for that.
Lay back in the couch and just take a deep breath.
That's right. At Agriculture Capital, we are a fund manager. We manage two funds, institutional grade capital, focused on permanent crop verticals on the West Coast and Australia. So we own farms, we own midstream packing and storage facilities, we own brands and marketing companies, and our job, our thesis is to create operational efficiencies across those businesses in four crops in particular: blueberries, hazelnuts, citrus, and grapes, table grapes. Over the life of our funds, our goal is to enhance the returns that we deliver to our investors through careful, thoughtful investment in sustainability innovation, which is exciting to me because, as you pointed out, very formative part of my career was my time at Stonyfield Farm, which folks will hopefully recognize as a company that I think helped create the conversation about sustainability in food and in consumer packaged good companies, you know, consumer companies in general, starting in 1983 and really just almost making the case for many, many companies around the world that there was a great alignment between values and financial success. And that's what we're trying to do at Agriculture Capital. You'll hear me referring to it as AC. We call ourselves AC. You know, we are looking for ways to align our very specific interest in managing risk for our investors, demonstrating responsibility for a variety of critical areas of risk, and then third, really aligning that with opportunities to generate returns or enhance our returns to those investments. And so you can imagine that takes a lot of forms in a business, you know, in businesses that are related to food production. Our purpose as an organization fundamentally is to grow access to better, healthier food. And so hopefully implicit in that concept, in that purpose statement, is this idea that, you know, we believe being able to bring much-needed scale to responsible, sustainable, regenerative production of food is going to help create access to that food for more and more people over time. And that's certainly a motivation for me. I think one of the challenges for me at Stonyfield was, you know, realizing that you go into a, you know, as Stonyfield grew and began to sell a lot of product into mainline grocery stores, you'd still go into the stores and see Stonyfield's price point being much higher than something else that was beginning to make the case down the shelf that it could also offer something healthy to consumers. And that gap, I think, created a dynamic that has made it, I think, hard for companies of that profile to really grow and connect with consumers, particularly consumers that are mostly price oriented. And so I got excited about this idea that, hey, if we were able to grow through responsible farming, responsible practices, responsible value chains, the crops that we grow and create markets for those crops and sell those crops to, you know, sell that food to people who might otherwise have not been able to support those responsible forms of production. We're doing more good for the world. We're trying to create more opportunity for that for more responsible modes of production. So that's super exciting to me. The form it takes for me, you know, we certainly are focused on water and energy management across our business. We certainly are focused on trying to innovate around packaging, and that's an interesting process, you know, in fresh produce, because there's, you know, the much of the innovation around packaging has happened on more value-added consumer packaged goods products. Transforming the fresh produce side of the business is really challenging for a lot of reasons, and we're working on that. But it's also taken the form of, you know, issues that I think are most that might be interesting to your audience about how we're delivering, how we're creating more habitat for native pollinators on our farms, how we're working with organizations to try to create a different vision for what the labor force looks like in our business, for example. And so that's a long answer. The short version of an answer to your question is we're looking at a lot of different issues that go into producing food and trying to find ways to identify impact projects, innovation projects that make sense economically. And by that I mean either reduce costs in the business or create value in the business, and we're well on our way in many areas. So,
Wood, thank you. That was a fantastic introduction. So I wanted to dive in. If you could identify one or two of those differentiators that you're looking at to try to create that either reduce costs or create value, I don't know if there's one or two examples that you could share where you're really starting to see that they are, in fact, impacting returns.
Sure. The one area that I just alluded to it, our work on native pollinators to me is emblematic of what we're trying to accomplish. We got really excited about a piece of academic research that was published in 2014 out of Michigan State University that suggested that, hey, if you soften the edges of a blueberry farm, even at a large scale farm, if you soften the edges of those farms to the tune of providing more habitat for native pollinators, even as much as 1% of the overall acreage of the farm, you have the potential to increase yields on those farms, reduce pest pressure on those farms, and otherwise create value. And so we decided, I should step back and say, when you look at native pollinator restoration in agricultural context. I mean, it's funny when I drive down the road and I see beehives, sitting beside a farm. I think we've almost gotten accustomed to seeing that. Maybe those of us who pay attention to to food production. I don't know if everybody notices those when they drive by them on the side of the road, but I always do. And to me, rather than feel like, oh, it's the honeybee is going to work, I look at that and I say, boy, that is an indication that somehow we have allowed this landscape to degrade to such a degree that instead of having native pollinators, native habitat that can work for us, a functioning, truly functional ecosystem services available to us, we have to go out and pay someone significant amount of money. I mean, sometimes to the tune of $900 an acre, to come out and bring their European honeybees to pollinate crops that we're growing on the West Coast or all over the country, for example. And that's a problem. I mean, there's a real risk there. There's obviously the cost that I alluded to. And then there's the fact that those kept bees, those honeybees, are also most susceptible to colony collapse disorder. So we're under a little bit of a, I would say, a pollination crisis. I'm not the first person to say that. There's plenty of information about that in the zeitgeist. But our interest here is to say, how can we bring back those functioning ecosystems and bring back the native bees, the native pollinators that can provide those services to us, ultimately to draw down cost over time, and to bring back on the value side, we hope that action will resonate with customers, will resonate with consumers about the kind of work that we're doing to sort of change that dynamic. So it's early days for us, Renee. We started our project a couple of years ago on our blueberry farms up in Oregon. We've been doing some field studies as we've installed pollinator meadows, pollinator hedgerows around our blueberry farms. And the great news is that we are seeing, particularly in the early part of the pollination cycle, we're seeing a lot more native pollinator activity in crop areas on the blueberry rows closest to our hedgerows than we are on the rows furthest away. So, that's an exciting piece of research that we're seeing, it's buoyed us so much. And by the way, I want to step back and say, we're not doing this on our own. We are relying on great expert organizations. We've really leaned into a relationship with the Xerces Society, which is an international organization focused on invertebrate conservation, who've been able to come out and help us really think about this from a scientific perspective and really design these areas optimally to both increase species presence but also overall abundance of native pollinators. So that's exciting. The good news, and so 2 years ago, I felt like we were, or 3 years ago, I felt like we were kind of a little bit of a voice in the wilderness thinking about this. I mean, there were some organizations that were doing it, but it wasn't something that was as widespread. Now, as we begin to expand that project or expand those projects to blueberry farms that we have in California and elsewhere, we are seeing seeing a lot more interest from public agencies, a lot more, just a lot of interest from the investment community about the potential contribution of this kind of work to better production over time. And I'd love to be able to say to you right now, Renee, it's very clear to us that we're able to we're seeing. You were seeing higher yields already. It is too soon in our process to be able to report that, but I am really excited about the headway we're making and the data that we've gathered to date about the activity that we're seeing and the species that are coming back. And I'm hopeful that in the next 2 to 3 years we're going to be able to have a much more interesting story to tell. We've attracted 2 grants from the state and federal grants to help us get our project in California underway, which is really exciting. And I will say, I think that's a helpful indicator. I think that we're not just going it alone. That there's a lot of folks out in the world who are beginning to think about these kinds of issues. You know, we're an investment organization. We're not a research organization. And so having the benefit of scientists and researchers who are working on this all the time, who are validating the work we're doing, is pretty exciting. So,
well, I think so. Also, what I find very exciting is by you guys doing this and potentially, it sounds like, kind of making sure that you're capturing the information and data from it, and potentially
Correct.
The willingness to then go ahead and share that is very exciting, because something that we've missed on the agriculture side is kind of these experiments at scale and securing mm-hmm. that data and disseminating that data for, you know, putting it into practice. So I think mm-hmm. that's fantastic. Thank you very much for sharing that example.
Well, and I would say one of the things, you know, we're really excited. We've built a relationship with an organization called the Natural Capital Project that might be great for you guys to talk to at some point. But they are quite interested in this element of our thesis and thinking about not just the potential to improve yields or reduce cost, but also the how activities like this create longer term, sort of more widespread societal and landscape value, and that's exciting to me to be able to be a part of that kind of conversation. So they've been able to do some research for us recently that we're really excited about, and it's kind of the tip of the iceberg a little bit, where we're sort of saying, okay, what are the benefits of some of the practices that we consider to be regenerative, the native pollinator work, our work on cover crops, our work on the fundamental sort of no-till or low-till aspects of permanent crop agriculture, for example, the use of composting on farms. You know, what are the benefits that those actually have? And you know, our early research on this is pretty exciting in terms of not only the amount of carbon that we're able to sequester through cover crops and permanent crop agriculture, but also their models to date, even without sort of being able to do that direct attribution of yield to pollinator activity, their models are showing significant economic impacts on broadly defined on farms like ours that have the benefit of native pollinator activity. That these activities are also resulting in increased nitrogen retention on farms, increased sediment retention on farms. So we're helping to avoid the loading of sediment to water bodies in critical areas. I think we know these things. I think we feel these things. I think we have great folks on our team who are leading our operations, who have been on the front lines of this kind of stewardship for a long time. But being able to sort of get into the weeds and really start to bring a data-driven approach to this, I think is going to be hopefully very transformative. And we've spent a lot of time trying to align ourselves with organizations like Natural Capital, and I mentioned Xerces and others that are interested in the long-term outcomes here. And hopefully we'll have, as I said, I'm happy to share some of that information. We actually are publishing our annual impact report later this summer, and some of this will be outlined in that material. But I'm always I always want to take a very modest and humble approach to how we talk about data, because I don't want to overstate the impacts that we're creating. And yet I am, as we mature as an organization, I'm getting more and more optimistic and excited. So
it's like the Moneyball effect for agriculture, right? You take a little of the gut feel, you throw it with some business intelligence suite and KPIs, and you make better decisions. I think that's a key step forward. I had a producer we used to deal with that would talk about what was happening when Terry Francona used to manage the Red Sox, and that struggle for him to convert over to using statistics to drive the lineup. Well, it's probably similar for many of the agriculturalists too. But let me actually revert back. The time about the pollination, which I found very interesting, and I'll tell you what, I never really looked at the hives as being a bit of a fictitious environment. But you're right, that's exactly what they are. It's a bit of due to the externalities of the practices we've taken. We've taken such a reductionist approach to not looking at systems approach, and there are certain links along the chain here that have been forgotten, or that we are kind of now coming to maybe a citizen's awakening that these are key and essential elements that that we can no longer continue with. So one of the questions that comes up maybe in an ideal world for food is the end result of these pollinators or soil health or whatever the practice that we need to revert back to is, it's not, you know, the question should be why is good food so expensive? Really, the question should be, why is conventional food so cheap? And it's because it forgets many of the externalities that we don't take into account the true costs. And those true costs can come with, you know, with soil health. It can come with degradation of land. It can come with the loss of pollinators. It can also come with not even calculating what's happening with water shortages in California, which I would guess drastically affect your portfolio companies within citrus and the shrubs and blueberries or hazelnuts, all the permacrops you deal with. So how do you express, or how are your companies, your portfolio companies, expressing those externalities, those true costs? How are they getting those values of their products out to the consumer base so that they realize they are spending a bit more for this, just like they do in Stonyfield, but there's quite a bit of value associated to that?
You know, Aaron, that is the $64,000 or $64 million, whatever the scale we're at these days, question. I mean, I believe, and I still come from a mindset that I believe that the more you tell stories about these kinds of issues, the more you talk about the true cost of what's involved in delivering better food to people. Certainly, the more younger generations. I used to think of myself as being in the younger generation, and now I'm realizing that's not true as I look in the mirror every day. But the more we engage a younger demographic that is going to be paying attention to those kinds of questions and being able to starting to ask those kinds of questions when they go into the store, I still have the belief that they're going to be willing to reward those companies that are committed to long-term environmental and community health. Now, today, in answer to your question, I think customers and consumers are really still, even in our business, most excited about the health benefits of blueberries, the flavor profile of blueberries, the flavor profile of certain citrus varieties, and so on. And less focused on making purchasing choices that are really specifically impact driven. Maybe the two of you can tell me otherwise from what your experience shows. But I used to be a lot more, I think, naive is the wrong word, but I'll just use it for now. Naive about that, and thought, well, you know, everybody thinks about impact when they make their purchases. But you know, as you said, I started an organization called Climate Counts back in 2006 that scored and ranked large companies what they were doing to address climate change. And the idea there was to engage consumers in this kind of conversation. We thought and believed that we could, and I think maybe the effects of that movement that was really seeding at that particular time maybe are beginning to play themselves out as we see more, you know, as consumers pay more and more attention to those kinds of questions. But you know, I think we believed as an organization that we could radically transform certain categories and really drive consumer consumers into the arms of companies that were climate leaders. It's complicated because, you know, it's funny that one of the companies that I always remember this, one of the companies that was, you know, in 2006, it was one of the lowest scoring companies on our, in our framework, was Amazon. And, you know, over the last 12 years, Amazon has taken over the world. So I have a little bit it's a hard question, Aaron. I mean, I want to believe that you know, our investment in regenerative practices is going to drive more consumers to the products that we produce. But I do believe, unfortunately, that the onus is on us to actually find ways to create value in our business in different ways. I mean, I think certainly, you know, as we mature and develop, you know, sort of brand strategies around the products that we grow, the products that we have in the market, you know, there's going to be a lot of opportunities, I hope. But I also believe that somehow we're having a conversation where we can't assume that we're going to change the citrus consumer overnight. The good news is that you know, a big part of our strategy on the blueberry side is really to be a leader in organic production. And we also would love to be doing the same thing in citrus, the same thing in hazelnuts, the same thing in grapes. For us on the blueberry side, that's become quite clear, and we are really focusing on the scale production of organic blueberries in a pretty significant way in our business. There are other challenges. You alluded to HLB on the citrus side of things. That's really made, I think, the expansion of organic citrus pretty challenging. Hazelnuts have something called Eastern Filbert Blight that also has that kind of impact as well, that make the toolkit that you need to be able to produce viable, you know, crops, and particularly from an investment perspective, viable crops, you know, you have to take advantage of a conventional toolkit. But you know, we remain hopeful that organic piece of the story, particularly on the blueberry side of things, is going to be a clear example of sort of how we engage more and more consumers. You know, certainly there's premiums associated with organic production. And with the benefit of our scale, we hope that'll, over time, create more access for more people.
Yeah, and Renee, sorry to step on your toes. I'll come to you in one second. But I do agree. I think one of those externalities, especially with things like blueberries, is people can materialize the effect on themselves. When you're dealing with persistent pesticides on berries and the impact it has with those neurotoxins and hormone disruptors on your children,
yep,
that's an easy decision to make for a couple of bucks more if you want those blueberries. And I think that does add some value. And I agree with you 100%, Wood, that those narratives, those stories of decommoditizing food in adding that constitute the values to that. And it's not just the white tablecloth restaurants. It's really, we got to get people thinking about this in their pantry. That's what matters the most. And I think what's exciting, we start looking at this as a macro trend, and whether it's here stateside or really globally, it is a generational conversation. There is an awakening associated to that. And for you as an investment firm, and for all of us dealing with producers on this, that younger generation is set to inherit $40 trillion in the next decade, which they're both investing and spending money on these elevated standards and practices. I think the other element to that, just to add one last bit, is we will not, to your point about the blights and what's happening with yellow dragon disease in citrus, is, you know, we won't be able to continue to operate at the same scale we have with business as usual. We will finally reach a ceiling where the margins won't be there. We cannot continue with those practices. So we'll have to look for those alternatives. It's a different operating model. I am looking positively here, and I think we all have to do that. But you can surely see those trends. And even I would say in the last few years, those positive trends are not just confirmation biased anymore. We really are seeing a drastic change. So, Renee, sorry, I stepped on your toes.
Oh, no, not at all. I just wanted to circle back. I think you're absolutely right on the storytelling to get to the true cost, Wood and Aaron, what you guys are talking about with the the consumers. But then would you mention that investors are already, the story's already resonating with investors, and you said that you're already starting to see different folks coming to the table based on what you guys are doing. I wondered if you could just talk a little bit about what you're seeing there in terms of, based on the stories that you're telling, that you're actually starting to see some some change?
Well, I hate to keep talking about the pollinator side of things, but you know, I wish, to be honest with you, I wish carbon markets were developed enough in the U.S. to sort of make that piece of it a more compelling part of the story. Because obviously, if we're paying the full price of carbon emissions in our in the U.S., the more sequestration, reduction in climate impact that an agricultural operation can have is going to have a whole different layer of value. And I think people are, frankly, waiting around. I think people are watching very carefully and waiting for that moment to arrive. I certainly want to keep politics out of this conversation. I'm not sure what to make of that in the current environment. Every day, when I see the news, I wonder how long that's going to be. But so I'd love to talk about that at some point. But today, the conversation really is on this pollinator side of things for us. And I think we've certainly had investors come to us and ask us more, really get focused on that conversation and ask us in more detail about sort of what that could ultimately mean. And I think they're not only thinking about it in the context of a blueberry business like ours or a permanent crop business like ours, but these are organizations that have large portfolios and own a lot of our agricultural land and are thinking about pollinator risk at a much grander scale than agriculture capital. And so I think the concepts that I'm teasing out here today on pollinator risk are just the tip of the iceberg, frankly, and so I think that is going to bring a lot more organizations to the table. I think certainly you've alluded to water as well, Aaron, and I think water is a big part of this too. California water is really challenging and something that we're trying to understand as much as we can, from an investment perspective. I think, for us, that means categorically investing in highest efficiency drip irrigation. It means investing in water storage on our ranches so that when there is water, during the wetter parts of the year, we're actually retaining that water so that we can use it in our operation as opposed to having it wash out into the ocean, for example, and so those are expenses that we're taking on in order to ensure long-term business continuity. Certainly leadership and responsibility, but also long-term business continuity. And our decision to invest in crops that really do have significant market value, I think, as the water landscape changes, dramatically, probably over the next decade, in California, that decision to be focused on those crops that, really are most appealing, most attractive, to consumers, is gonna help us make good decisions and help, I think, drive the agricultural landscape in many ways away from crops and production that doesn't generate as much value and isn't itself sort of as focused, allow as much focus on efficiency and innovation. We're super interested in the conversation around groundwater recharge in California. It's interesting, and this is similar to the pollinator conversation. It is interesting on groundwater recharge because the more you invest in micro irrigation, drip irrigation, and so on, the less your operations recharge groundwater aquifers, which is interesting because that's where a lot of the issues in California are now related to groundwater management and land subsidence in the Central Valley, for example, and we need to get more water back into the ground. So you are seeing some really interesting organizations that I deeply admire that are focused on pilot projects that are looking at ways to manage California land to enable to get more water back into the ground, and we're certainly thinking about that, and certainly think that shoring up that water risk long term through techniques like that can be really beneficial in an investment context.
Deep water drilling is definitely of vast concern, and for so long California's water rights have been an interesting dynamic in itself. So that's very positive discussion, and maybe picking the right crops to grow in the right areas instead of flooding alfalfa in certain valleys that are deserts might be a better approach to grow things that you can use drip. So I think that's all of that is becoming a much smarter and pragmatic approach for many reasons. So what in your last, let me ask this, in his previous book, Stirring It Up, your past boss, Gary Hirschberg, said you have to have a seat at the table, effectively meaning you have to, 99% of agriculture is controlled by large seed companies, chemical companies, very large producers, things that we all are familiar with conventional agricultural systems. A lot of these discussions, though, that we're chatting about might be ingenuity, innovation, really just aligning with a new consumer base. And I'm going to take you back in the way back machine to Climate Count days here, because I think you were onto something. You might have been premature. You might have been involved. And as you know, I've been involved in that program too through your who took it over after you with Mike Bellamente. You know, I think that the context was proper. This seemed to be it was maybe just too early for that. It was maybe the consumer base wasn't there. But it does seem that those larger players are trying to engage in the dynamic of a consumer that is more interested in these things. How have you seen, or what have you guys done to take that seat at the table with your companies, with leadership position in obviously these impact papers that you're putting out for practical models for regenerative food? So what have you seen, and where, what can we expect to see in the future?
You know, it's a great point and a great question, and I think you know, I'm hopeful that through an openness, and certainly one of the things I feel like I learned or connected with Gary and with Stonyfield about was this belief that, hey, you know, we're not adversarial with civil society, with the nonprofit community, with academic organizations, with government agencies, and we're in this together, and I think unfortunately all too often food producers, consumer packaged goods companies in general, take a very defensive posture when it comes to building a different way of thinking about what they produce and what their role in the world actually is, and Stonyfield was very much focused on engaging actively, very humbly and openly with nonprofits and with citizen organizations, and I believe we've brought that same spirit to bear on our work at AC. My hope is that we can over time change this. There's this very strong dogma, I think, that exists in some parts of the agricultural landscape around, you know, that the only way to be responsible, the only way to drive to our regenerative solutions is to be a local producer, to be a small or medium-sized producer. And unfortunately, I simply don't believe that's the case anymore. I think we have to have more organizations like Agriculture Capital who are values-driven, who are purpose-driven, who are trying to do at scale, frankly, the same things that smaller local producers are doing. And I think, hopefully, that will translate into increased value for consumers, more consumers over time. More consumers will ultimately be exposed to what regenerative agriculture is, to what organic food is, to what sustainability actually is, through the involvement at scale of larger organizations. Yes, there are challenges with you know, managing large areas of large farmland, you know, large acreage, and bringing the same level of sort of nuanced care to a piece of ground that someone who farms 10 acres might be able to. But it should not be a limiting factor. That should not be a limiting factor. There is now technology. There are now tools available to us that I think can help us transform what quote-unquote big agriculture means in a changing world. And so, you know, that sounds audacious, but that's our goal. There's nothing short. That our desire is to is to help people understand that all the great work that's been done at a small scale can be done by larger growers and larger producers, and that's going to be the way that we ultimately feed the world with regenerative food, ultimately feed the world with organic food, ultimately create better year-round jobs for agricultural laborers. We build real economic opportunity around farming and bring that millennial generation back into farming, because as we all know, we have an aging agricultural landscape, and we've got to change that.
Well, fantastic stuff, Wood. That is great insight, and thank you for sharing that. And Renee, did I tell you that I can predict the future? So in 10 years' time, I see agriculture capital buying Amazon, the whole thing, buying them, taking them private, and making it a regenerative agricultural company. I see it. It's going to be, cast that in stone. It's good stuff. Wood, where can we learn more about agriculture capital? Is best place on your website? And when will we be able to see your next impact report?
The impact report will be out by Labor Day, and it'll be on our website, which is agriculturecapital.com. And that's where we are.
Great. I'll put a link at the write-up at the bottom of the page for that, too, and let people go and access that. Renee, final thoughts?
Yeah, I just wanted to second, Wood, I'm also very optimistic and excited about the future. I mean, having worked at one of the industry incumbents, so John Deere for, almost 10 years, we're starting to see some players that are shaking up the industry. And I think it will force some change. And for example, we're seeing Indigo is really kind of making causing people to sit up and pay attention. FBN, Farmers Business Network, is doing something similar. And I think those types of companies who have pretty significant investment are really starting to drive change in the industry. And I'm very excited about that. And then also I've been doing quite a few farmer interviews for various clients over the last few months, Midwest farmers. And it's wonderful to hear. We're talking over 10,000 acre farmers who have daughters that are vegan, and they are trying to understand how they can, in fact, start to produce differently. What are the tools that they can use to bring more regenerative farming practices to their scaled operations? So I agree with your optimism, and I'm similarly optimistic.
Fantastic. Super. Renee, thank you so much for taking the time to co-host today. And Wood Turner, thank you so much for sharing the knowledge with our listening audience. I greatly appreciate you taking the time.
It's a pleasure. Thanks,
Wood. Until next time, we'll take care.